Thank you for joining me. I'm Julie Ballou, and this is Rape the Podcast. Trigger warning on this episode. I want to bring some perspective to the advancements we've made in recent years and show just how far we've come. We've made so much progress in what really is a short amount of time comparatively to modern day American civilization, where rape was seemingly an acceptable and even somewhat expected act, never talked about and not really considered a crime until maybe the last half century when women's rights began to blossom. An article published by the Arkansas Journal of Social Change and Public Service says, the Code of Hammurabi, one of the earliest sets of written laws, considered the rape of a virgin as property damage against her father. For a long time, the rape of a woman was considered a property crime against the victim's husband or father. The word itself derives from the Latin word rapire, or seize. It wasn't until the 11th and 12th centuries that rape began to be considered more as a violent sexual crime against the victim. At the end of the 13th century, the statutes of Westminster allowed the crown to prosecute rapists should the victim's family choose not to do so, signifying a fundamental change in rape being viewed as a crime against the state. Early American colonies defined rape at the common law as carnal knowledge of a woman 10 years or older, forcibly and against her will. In the late 1800s, temperance and suffrage activists successfully advocated to raise the legal age of consent from 10 to between 14 and 18, depending on the state. Women of color endured even more dire conditions. During the 1800s, most states excluded Black women, both free and enslaved, from rape laws. Slave women frequently endured violent sexual abuse, which often resulted in pregnancy. If a slave woman attempted to defend herself against such abuse, she would be beaten severely. It was not until 1861 that a Black woman could even file rape charges against a white man. Nearly 100 years later, the anti-rape movement emerged as violence against women became a central point in the second wave feminist movement. The 1960s onward ushered in significant progress in American rape law. It was during this time that rape began to be viewed as a weapon, driven by the desire to exert control over women. Prior to the 1970s, marital rape, or the raping of one spouse by the other, was exempt from many rape laws. In 1976, however, Nebraska became the first state to make marital law a crime. Go Nebraska! In 1993, marital rape was a crime in all 50 states. Perhaps the most significant change came in 1975, when Congress adopted rules 412, 413, 414, and 415 into the Federal Rules of Evidence. These rules, more commonly known as rape shield laws, limit the defendant's ability to probe into the sexual behavior, history, or reputation of the alleged victim. Prior to 1975, defendants could attack an alleged victim's credibility by presenting evidence of the victim's sexual activity. The public humiliation and embarrassment of having their sexual history dragged out in court became a strong incentive for victims not to report sex crimes. Subject to limited and strict exceptions, Rules 412 through 415 of the Federal Rules of Evidence prevents evidence of a victim's sexual history from being used to discredit him or her. I remember what a huge impact the Jodie Foster movie The Accused made on middle-class America in 1988. It's a movie that centered on what victim blaming actually looked like.
Did you have anything to drink before you went to the mill? Or smoke anything?
Oh, half a joint, a couple beers, you know. Nothing heavy.
And while you were there?
I don't know. I mean, I wasn't falling down drunk or anything.
How were you dressed?
What's that supposed to mean?
It means were you dressed provocatively? Showing a lot of cleavage, see-through blouse?
What the fuck difference does it matter how I was dressed? They tore it off of me.
But did how you dress make those guys think that they could have sex with you? Did you put on a show?
What the hell are you talking about? You saw me at the hospital. What, you think I asked for that? Is that what you think? If
That's what you think. You get the fuck out of my house.
Why didn't you tell me that you had a record?
Fuck you.
Based on a true story, Jodie Foster plays Sarah Tobias, a poster girl for Asking for It, gang raped by three men in the back room of a crowded bar over a pinball machine. Her three rapists succumb to a plea bargain to reduce their charges to aggravated assault, and they're sentenced to kind of a short amount of time. Sarah eventually convinces the character played by Kelly McGinnis. She plays the district attorney who handles her case to finally open her eyes to what happened, and she's convinced to take even the bystanders who cheered and chanted on the rapist in the bar to court. It's quite a movie, and if you haven't seen it, you should if you can. But it's strong, trigger warning AF. I remember my thoughts in the 80s was like, you mean she didn't deserve it? You mean it was wrong for people to stand around and cheer on a rape on top of a pinball machine in the back of a bar? A rape to a drunk woman wearing a short skirt who'd flirted with every dude in the bar? You mean this is a crime? It was actually surprising to me. I was only 17 at the time, and at the height of my hypersexuality that I now know is common among young rape victims. I feel like this movie was an important step, especially in my life, turning minds and hearts more towards the victim. Before that, people were mainly concerned with how rape allegations might hurt the accused perpetrator's reputation. Then came high-profile cases, which spurred states to reconsider statutes of limitations for rape. From the Catholic Church to campus rape stories like Brock Turner to Bill Cosby, Harvey Weinstein, there's too many to name. Finally, the Me Too movement. And now, according to RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, as of 2022, 49 American states have updated their statute of limitations for sex crimes to allow victims to come forward years later, as much as a lifetime. The states all vary, and New Jersey's five-year statute of limitations is one of the shortest in the country. But the states all vary a lot. In my state of Missouri, there's no time limit for commencing legal proceedings against a perpetrator of first-degree rape and attempted first-degree rape. Just as an example, let's examine what first-degree rape is defined as in the state of Missouri. Under Missouri Revised Statute 566.030, an individual is guilty of rape in the first degree if they have sex with an incapacitated person, like a person who is in a coma or passed out drunk, engage in sexual intercourse with a person who doesn't have the capacity to give consent, physically force or threaten force against another person to have sexual intercourse against that person's wishes, for example, forcible compulsion, or attempt to commit any of the actions that we listed. It's important to note that slipping a drug into someone else's drink that renders them incapacitated is also considered forcible compulsion. To continue our look at first-degree rape, here are the penalties listed in the Missouri statutes. The penalties for rape or attempted rape in the first degree depend on the circumstances. For instance, a first-time offender can expect a lighter prison sentence than a persistent sexual offender. The minimum prison sentence for first-degree rape is 5 years. Five, according to Missouri Revised Statute 566.125. Most crimes cannot be prosecuted after a certain amount of time passes. However, that's not the case with first-degree rape charges in Missouri. There is no statute of limitations for first-degree rape charges. That means that an individual can be arrested and go to prison for first-degree rape, even if it happens 10 years ago. But all this jargon, legal mumbled jumbo, is important to get some good legal advice on. Maybe at the Family Justice Center here in Springfield, you can talk to them about how your circumstances could play out in charges. But the different charges have all kinds of different varying degrees in different states. There's a complete list on RAIN's website in the show notes. But let's just agree, things are improving. But hey, we're not forgetting that there's a lot further to go. For example, the minimum of 5 years for a first-degree murder rape seems low. That's why we're keeping track and fighting for more change, right? So I want to state the obvious. We need that DNA, people. We gotta keep making it clear that the path to a safer community with mentally healthy citizens in it starts with capturing these motherfuckers and punishing them. And we have a much better chance of doing that by collecting their DNA. We wanna get that rape kit done. After that, we wanna test that rape kit and associated evidence for DNA. It's science's gift to us. Let's be grateful. Let's use it. Audrey McCormick, supervisor with the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office and their Special Victims Unit, explained recently during a Missouri Sexual Assault Task Force meeting, as long as a kit is unreported in any prosecutor's office, they're not going to be able to prosecute a suspect for that particular offense. They have to have a report and an investigation and have an identified victim in order to get to the point of filing charges and prosecuting an individual. Generally speaking, here in Missouri, for a felony offense, the state would be barred from prosecution after about 3 years have passed. There are some exceptions to that rule that might extend the clock, but generally it's 3 years for a felony crime. After that point in time, the state would be barred from filing charges. That same prohibition exists for misdemeanors as well. It's 1 year for misdemeanors. However, for sexual offenses, now Missouri has no statute of limitations for the most egregious sexual offenses involving adults. And there's no statute of limitations for any sexual offense involving a person under the age of 18. If it is a registrable offense, meaning you have to register as a sex offender, that includes dozens and dozens of offenses that may not have a statute of limitations that could potentially be filed at any point in time. And so when we're talking about the benefit of holding on to unreported kits and their associated evidence that may not fit inside the kit, it is just so beneficial to have DNA in a sexual assault case. Even if it isn't conclusive proof that a sexual assault has occurred, it still will help in figuring out how the case is going to be presented and what the potential defenses might be. McCormick says in a stranger assault, DNA will help link the suspect and their survivor. If there is no relationship, it helps to remove a potential defense of, well, this didn't even happen, and so prove that they were indeed with this person at that time. It helps to remove a potential defense of, well, this didn't even happen, and so prove that they were indeed with this person at that time. In circumstances where we have a suspect who will say, I don't even know that person, and then DNA is found in a place that would indicate that there had been sexual contact, at that point, the case gets much stronger. It can also help to narrow down all of the defenses to it. Consent defense, if there's DNA, even if there's a known relationship between the suspect and the survivor. It helps to look down the road to trial when they're assessing the strength of the evidence. And so DNA is always beneficial. But DNA can remain on items collected in the kit as well as some of the associated items like bed sheets and things like that for a substantial period of time. Finding DNA on either an item within the kit or outside of the kit can mean the difference between filing and not filing a case or getting a conviction in a case. And so maintaining all of this evidence will allow them to prosecute more offenders and maybe most importantly, do it on the survivor's timeline. So the rape kit, with DNA samples or the lack of, or any of the associated evidence, is worth keeping in a safe place, even if a victim survivor is not ready to report the event to the police. Back to the story of how my community is working to improve its response to clearing the backlog of rape kits. On September 23rd, 2021, I put on my mask and attended a press conference after I heard about it on the morning news show I watch every morning. Hearing a rape kit story on the news grabbed my attention, and I bravely left my house after what seemed like a few years of not leaving the house. The last 2 years of time were pretty confusing, right? Anyway, this was great news for Springfield, Missouri.
In a few moments, I'll ask the chief to deliver a few remarks, but first, I'd like to provide a reminder of how we got here today, and then to give an update on where we are with the Safe Kit Initiative overall. We launched the Safe Kit Initiative with a grant from the federal government. When we launched, we challenged ourselves to identify, log, and clear the entire backlog of untested sexual assault kits that were being stored, and in many cases forgotten, and gathering dust on shelves at hospitals, police departments, and throughout the state. Through months and months of work and many miles of traveling the highways and back roads throughout this great state, Nikki and her team were able to find and log almost 4,500 untested reported kits. That's a shocking number for all of us to hear, no doubt. But we didn't let the weight of those numbers slow us down. We quickly got to work getting the kits shipped to independent labs for testing and uploading eligible DNA results into the FBI's Combined DNA Index System, or the CODIS system. By the way, the very first regional shipping event was held right here in Springfield back in January of 2020. Those shipping events, testing, and CODIS uploads have continued throughout the pandemic, thanks to Mickey's leadership and the cooperation of law enforcement, healthcare organizations that were particularly strapped during the height of the pandemic. But the work doesn't end there. When CODIS hits are received, meaning DNA from the kit matches an offender already in the system, our office then works with the Missouri Highway Patrol and local law enforcement to work up the case for prosecution. Then we refer it out to the appropriate local prosecutor wherever possible and offer assistance from our office. There's a lot of moving parts to the initiative. So, where do we stand today? What are the numbers so far? We've shipped, so far, 2,101 kits to the lab. Of those shipped and tested, 963 have returned with DNA results. Of the 963 kits returned with DNA results, 352 were eligible for CODIS upload and returned 155 hits. So far, our office has made 35 criminal referrals to local prosecutors and investigators, and many others are ongoing. And while we have made great progress so far, we're not going to stop until we get every single department in the state to zero untested kits in their inventory like we have here in Springfield today, all with the goal of seeking justice for those who've been victimized through these violent and vile acts of terror. Make no mistake, this is an aggressive goal, but we have a plan on how we're going to achieve that. Number one, we've been aggressive in seeking both federal and state funding for the effort. We asked for and received two federal grants totaling $4.8 million to help fund our efforts. And our office was so fortunate that this year's legislative session, the Missouri State Legislature provided an additional $2.6 million in funding to clear the remaining backlog. And I really want to thank the legislature, in particular local Senator Lincoln Huff, for his leadership and the legislature's leadership and willingness to stand up for victims of sexual assault. With the volume of kits that's needed to be tested, we couldn't just go to the laboratory that we'd previously been doing the test kits. There simply wasn't enough. They simply wouldn't be able to test all of the kits in a timely manner. So we aggressively solicited bids and signed contract with several other private labs across the country and have already started shipping kits to them for testing. Three, and I want to acknowledge the additional funding and assistance from Springfield, which provided much needed and appreciated funding to test the remaining kits here. So thank you, the mayor is here. Thank you very much. Finally, we're working against the clock and have given ourselves a very aggressive timeline for completion. For example, the money that the state legislature appropriated must be spent by July of 2022. So the team is working literally day and night to get the remaining kits sent to labs for testing. I know that's a lot of information I've given you here today, and I know you may have some questions that we can answer at the end. But before I turn it over to Chief Williams for his remarks, I want to say a few words about the importance of the initiative and what it means to me on a personal level. I've talked about numbers, the number of kits identified, the number of sent off to lab, how much money we've received to tackle the problem, the number of hits and cases that have been referred, and those are all great to help tell the story of the scope of the problem. But the numbers don't tell the story of the victims, the human beings whose lives will forever be changed and marred by the violence and senseless acts they've suffered. Those victims' nightmares aren't over. Their past will not be erased. The damage can't be undone. Yet still, we do this for them, the victims, so at least we can seek answers and pursue justice. As a husband, as a father, as the Attorney General, those victims are at the heart of the numbers here and drive what we do every single day with this initiative. Thank you. Chief Williams.
Thank you, sir. First, let me say this is the culmination of a long journey, both for victims of sexual assault and for the officers of Springfield Police Department. Back in 2014, I attended training on violence against women training put on by the federal government. And at that training, there were some discussion about a change in culture in law enforcement need to take place about sexual assault kit testing and the victims of sexual assault and those kits that weren't tested for a variety of reasons. And the impetus, the emphasis was on really law enforcement should be testing all of those in some way, shape, or form. Came back from that training and I asked my investigators, said, do we have any backlogged sexual assault kits? We did. We had kits sitting on shelves that had been there for a variety of reasons. Lab capacity was one. Victim cooperation was another. Investigative resources through the prosecutor's office was another. But I made the determination that time that we were going to stop backlogging. So we started sending all of our kits from that point forward to the crime lab. Whether they got tested at that time or not, whether they sat there and awaited funding, that was okay. But we weren't going to send them to our private room and let them sit in the shelves anymore. That started this process shortly thereafter, discussions nationwide about the backlog kits across the country, and then began working with the Attorney General's office at the state level to see how we could do something about those issues here in Missouri. Fast forward a couple years, and literally, and as the Attorney General knows, in the political realm, sometimes it takes years to get things done. So fast forward to 2019, when I worked with the Attorney General's office, we successfully got a grant from the federal government to start providing funding for backlog kits. And working with Mickey and her folks, started the inventory process to see how many there were across the state. We knew how many we had. So today's the culmination of that. We were able to, back in 2019, we discovered we had 231 sexual assault kits still sitting in our property room. And through that process, we were able to get all 231 of those tested. Money from the grant absolutely helped. We're still participating in those shipping events, but we've shipped off through the grant process 112 of those kits. And then working with our sexual assault task force that the mayor and city council here in Springfield put together, one of the recommendations from that group that I was pleased and honored to work with was we need to do something locally. We can't just depend on the state or the federal government. So through their efforts and a push through city council approved $120,000 to get all of our other kits tested. So we sent off 119 kits just last month to get all of them to the lab for testing. Thought I was done. So mentioned this morning, the last 15 kits were sent off. Those were kits that had been sitting at the crime lab here in Springfield, Missouri State Highway Patrol Crime Lab, that we'd sent before. They hadn't been sent for testing yet. Do their backlog. We got those sent off through the efforts of this grant. So I can honestly, truly say we are at zero untested backlog kits. And I can't thank my partners in the state level, the federal level, city council, task force members for getting us to that point. And then just to piggyback on what the Attorney General said about the results of those, we have received out of those 35 across the state, 11 CODIS hits here in Springfield. And six of those cases are currently under investigation, working with the victims on all of those hits to notify them and follow their wishes on what they wish to do as far as moving forward. And we hope to have some justice for those victims sometime in the near future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you, Chief. Any questions? Yes, ma'am.
Can you tell if all of these efforts and every all the social work that you've done has made an impact on victims in the area? Have you seen an increase in reporting?
I can tell you that I've talked to victims who've reached out and are just very appreciative that law enforcement are really kind of been galvanized to do the work that should have been done a long time ago, right? That they feel heard, that they feel like someone's listening. And I think that's a very important message to have out there, that if you are a victim of sexual assault, to come forward. We want to do everything we can to support you and to prosecute the person who's committed a really terrible and violent act. But I think my hope is that it'll provide closure for a lot of victims out there that thought that their case was forgot about and there was no justice that came from it. And I think that's a very important thing for the public to know, but specifically for the victims to know.
Now that Springfield has worked through its backlog, how does Springfield compare to other cities that also have large backlogs like ours?
I would say Springfield's been a real leader, and the chief is really in the department, and I know the working group that they have taken this on and taken ownership of it, and that's really important. What we want to provide in the office, because we have statewide reach and a lot of those resources, that is to provide as much support as we can, a coordinated effort, but it takes local leadership to get to where we are today. So I certainly commend the chief and the mayor and everybody who's been involved. And I mentioned Lincoln Up, somebody from Southwest Missouri that helped champion that in the budget to get the additional funding. So that's what it takes, because it's just unacceptable that you would have thousands and thousands of these untested sexual assault kits sitting on shelves. But the good news is we want to be a leader across the country. This isn't unique to Missouri. Sadly, this is not unique to our state. We certainly want to make sure Missouri is a leader in moving forward to get these tested, get the results back, and move forward with prosecutions.
Out of those 35 referrals, any arrests?
I think that 6 are currently under investigation.
We don't have any arrests here yet. They're under investigation. I don't think out of the other 35.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think there's been any arrest charges filed yet on those.
Yeah, I can tell you that there are some cases likely that will be public soon. That's fair to say. But again, it's sort of a staging of all this, right? You get them tested, you get it back, there's hits, you work with local law enforcement, there's an investigation that happens in the prosecution. So unfortunately, this stuff doesn't happen overnight, but we want to make sure we get it right. And I think, victims have waited long enough, so we want to move as expeditiously as possible to bring them justice. Okay? Thank you, guys. Thanks for being here. Thanks for all your work. Appreciate it.
Now that we know how freaking important rape kits are, let's backtrack to talk more about the exam that's conducted after an assault to collect that DNA and other evidence. In the next episode, I'll speak with registered nurse Dawn Day. She is the supervisor of the SANE program at Mercy Hospital in Springfield, Missouri.
They're not refusing care. They're declining it. And it's very often they're declining that option because of pain or discomfort or fear. So they're never refusing to cooperate. That's something that we drive into the minds of SANE nurses and providers, even law enforcement. That verbiage should never be used with victims.
No.
They're not refusing care. They're not refusing and they're not uncooperative. They have just been through a traumatic experience and their brain physiologically can only handle so much.
Yeah.
So if there's something that they're like, I just can't do that right now, they've deferred that due to the trauma that they have just experienced.
If you have a story that you would like to share on this podcast, my phone number is 417-763-1382. Please call and leave a message if I don't answer. You can also email springfieldapc@gmail.com. I want to include some more stories, so those will be coming up in some future episodes. And if you need help, if you're struggling, please call 1-800-656-HOPE. And the good folks at RAIN are there to help you find the resources and the help that you need. Thank you for listening. I'm Julie Ballew, and this is Rape the Podcast.